Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and it is my extreme pleasure to be back here bringing to you this webinar entitled Email is Hot, Texting is Hotter, Don't Be the First to Get Burned, Part 2. We started this webinar last week, and our presenters, Roseanne Anderson and David Kaminsky, had so much information that they couldn't get through it all in an hour. And we are incredibly lucky that they're back here with us today to walk through this important information while also answering your questions about text messaging and email in collections. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Ontario Systems. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. For those of you who don't know what accountsrecovery.net is by now, I hope you should. The objective is for the site is to provide news and information in a variety of formats for everyone in the credit collection industry. Best of all, it's free. Check it out as soon as this webinar is over today. To properly impress you that the people you are listening to today know their stuff, let me tell you a little bit about Roseanne and David, today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She's responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her 2 decades of experience in the RM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the industry. David Kaminsky is the chair of the Consumer Financial Services Law Practice at Carlson & Messer. He represents creditors, banks, debt collectors, and asset buyers in the defense of claims brought under all federal and state consumer protection statutes. He manages the nationwide litigation for numerous financial institutions and has helped shape the law affecting the rights of collections agencies and creditors throughout the United States. He also provides compliance and training advice and successfully defends clients against federal and state regulatory actions. David was a 2019 ACA Foundation Award recipient, the 2016 Attorney of the Year, and the 2013 to 2015 Chair of the Attorney's Division of ACA International. David and Roseanne are going to briefly summarize what they shared last week and then continue through and dive through the rest of their awesome presentation. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email Saturday, to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and find the speakers you want to hear from. Before I bring on David and Roseanne to begin their presentation, I wanted to remind everybody that this webinar is being brought to you by Ontario Systems, which has helped ARM organizations grow and prosper since 1980. Whether you need improved contact management, texting and integrated payment processing, better reporting on agent productivity, or a compliance audit, Ontario Systems can help. Please visit www.ontariosystems.com to learn more. Now with that, let me bring on Roseanne to pick up where we left off in last week's webinar. Roseanne.
Thank you, Mike. welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming back. Today, we're going to pick up where we left off, which was the point where we were just starting to talk about the CTIA, the Cellular Telephone and Internet Association. It's a self-regulatory body that really represents just a multitude of organizations, but not the least of which are the actual cell or mobile phone carriers. And this organization basically governs all the short code programs. Last week we talked about keywords, the words that a consumer would send or text to a short code, a 5 or 6 digit number. And that's what CTIA regulates, and it separate and independent from any legal requirements or from the carrier's requirements. So when people ask about, well, can we get sued for violating the CTIA? The answer is absolutely not. You're not going to get sued for violating a CTIA requirement any more than a consumer is going to bring a private right of action under NACHA, the National Automated Clearinghouse Association, if you violate the contract regarding the ACH network. But nonetheless, it is the monitoring body that will overview, and oddly enough, they don't read every text that is sent, but they do review from any text service provider the actual content of the templates. Let's go to the next slide. The CTIA has some basic compliance principles that we do need to be mindful of and adhere to in order to actually launch a successful text messaging program. So the way they say it, consumers must be aware of what they're signing up to receive. Another way of saying it, they can't be deceived into what they're signing up to receive. If they're signing up to engage in a engage with your third-party debt collection agency about a past due obligation, for example, they need to be made aware that that is the purpose of the text as opposed to some other laudable goal, such as improving your finances, etc. They want clarity. Offer clear opt-in mechanisms. Consumers basically have to opt into their keyword and recurring message programs. I may have talked about this last time, but a recurring message program in this context does not have anything to do with Reg E. It's not about recurring payments. I know the word is used again, but what a recurring message program triggers would be rules surrounding what is required if you're going to allow a consumer to sign up for a message that on a regular basis will come to them from you about something. Typical examples outside of our industry would be the weather, Delta updates, new fares, etc. That you may fare watch programs that you may sign up for. Also, send in opt-in confirmation messages. When a consumer opts in, they must know that they have opted in or subscribed to, that's another way of saying it, a text message program. And similarly, when they opt out or unsubscribe, cancel, terminate, stop, whatever word you want to use, they must receive an acknowledgement that their opt-out has been acted on. Next slide.
Roseanne, quick question. Mm-hmm. Who is to stop someone basically from using an abbreviation that the CTIA does not either approve or condone? I mean, what happens? How does that work?
The CTIA would, if they didn't like the particular abbreviation, first of all, we'll get to that in the next slide, we'll talk about terms and conditions, but people do have to understand and be told what the abbreviations are abbreviations for. And the abbreviation cannot be of a word that the abbreviation would be insulting, inflammatory, vulgar. The abbreviation must be basically easy to understand and identified and described in the terms and conditions. So if for some reason, I'm not going to make up the vulgar word, but if for some reason you abbreviated please pay on Friday, whatever, and you use some sort of an abbreviation of that or an acronym, you would not want that acronym or abbreviation to say to be the equivalent of a swear word, for example. But anyway, they are the ones that would monitor that, if not the consumer's lawyers under the FDCPA or UDEP. Text messaging for third-party collections, terms and conditions is a big deal. Now, people, I think you've heard, many of you may have heard me say already, if you see a billboard on the highway that says text pizza to Domino's, for example, text pizza to 12345, which is Domino's, that's, by the way, that isn't actually real. I'm just making that up. But anyway, you don't need terms and conditions to get a free pizza coupon. Okay, it just doesn't work that way. But in the world of financial services, whether it's from the creditor, a first-party collector, a third-party collector, terms and conditions surrounding their text message program are incredibly important. For example, this is where you may be able to put the full mini Miranda in the communication. This is now when it comes to a subsequent disclosure requirement, any communication subsequent to the initial, as you know, the FDCPA and almost all state laws require that you make clear that it's a communication from a debt collector, though you do not have to use that exact language. For example, in our text templates, they all say for the third party world, they all say ABC collection agency, a debt collector, so that we meet that disclosure requirement. But beyond that, let's go to the next slide. Terms and conditions also address vagaries in the law, areas where, for example, I just told you a few seconds ago that the CTIA requires us to confirm by send a confirmation text that the consumer has in fact been opted out or unsubscribed from the program in response to their request for that to happen. There have been some court cases that have said, well, no, no, no. If they said stop, that means stop. Don't send them anything else. But the CTIA rules say, no, you have to send the confirming email. So the terms and conditions can be used to bridge that gap between an FDCPA requirement and a CTA requirement, whereby the consumer is actually agreeing not to give up a right, but to agree that they are going to authorize one last confirming text if and when they unsubscribe or stop. Terms and conditions address vagaries in the law, make clear that text messaging is voluntary, pretty much just it lays up. By the way, I also consider terms and conditions not a nice to have, but a must have. And I like it to be structured in the form of an agreement. So as what I mean by that is the consumer is provided with the terms and conditions, and then to agree to subscribe to this text program and indicate your agreement with the terms and conditions, text yes, for example. You actually get their assent to that agreement. Next slide. I think we're on to e-sign at this point.
Yes, I did have a question for you. One second. Going back to what you're saying with the CTIA offering an option for an opt-in for recurring messages, that's not something that's necessarily been clarified in the CFPB's proposed debt collection rule, that they have to offer an opt-in when sending a text message or an email. Is that something you think they'll somehow get reconciled as this all gets worked out and we get a final, you get closer to a final rule?
Right. Well, for the recurring message, I think let's just, first of all, I agree the new rules, proposed rules do not address recurring text message programs. Second of all, I do anticipate these rules running in tandem with one another so that they complement, not conflict with one another when all is said and done. But
right.
Even the new rules, what people have to realize about the new rules as proposed, they don't do away with TCPA requirements. The TCPA is alive and well, even in the new world of debt collection under the proposed rule structure. So you will need consent. Now, whether it's an actual opt-in per se, or if it can, you need the consumer's consent to send a text to them, but whether or not you need a full-blown opt-in to a recurring message program, I'm not prepared to evaluate based on the new rules because they're silent.
Okay. Got it. Okay, thank you. David, we're going to bring you on, but I think we wanted to go back first, right, and start and talk about Lavalee?
Well, I think, Mike, we're going to go to eSign first.
Okay,
and I think that makes sense. Thank you, everyone, again, for being with us. We're greatly appreciative. Roseanne and I are going to focus in part on the e-sign and electronic delivery of certain documents. We're going to focus a bit on email, the rules, but we're also going to talk to you about the practical considerations and the things that you need to be consider when you're really literally rolling out a program and what's real world instead of some hypothetical or some ethereal issue that really isn't going to be relevant. So that's what we're hopefully imparting today. And I think because we're going to do it that way, I think it's also going to trigger many questions from you. So let's talk about the eSign Act. First of all, the eSign Act, Mike, let's go to 26 first and then back it up to 25. So the eSign Act, like, what is it? And we've talked about this last time. And that eSign Act basically it gives the persons, once you get eSign consent, to then provide electronic signatures for documents that otherwise you would normally send with just pen and paper or ink, such as a 1692G notice that you would put in the mail, right? It's also, this is a law. Remember, this is Congress's law. They passed it and they made it clear that digital documents, such as email, such as text, right, and properly executed contracts, they're going to have the same force and effect legally as if, quote, they were sent via regular mail and received in the normal course of business, again, such as a 1692G notice. And it's basically, it's the substitution. What you're really doing is saying, look, instead of me sending you the 1692G notice, I'm going to send you this email in the place of that. And that email that standard email is going to be a substitute in the place of me hand delivering something to you via mail, certified mailer. However, I would mail that to you as I have done in the past. Mike, go back to 25. So eSign Act, what does this law say in short and how do we make it easy? It basically says this: if there's a statute or regulation or some kind of law that deals with the issue of providing or making available to a consumer something in writing, such as the 1692G notice, for an example, and we're going to get into that and clarify it. But if there's some statute that says you must send someone something by mail, or you must send someone a written notice, such as the EFTA, when the EFTA discusses providing a consumer in writing the terms of a recurring payment program that you entered into with the consumer, then you can substitute that with an electronic transmission only if you already got e-sign permission. And in order to get e-sign permission, the consumer has to basically consent thereto, right? They have to consent thereto and not have withdrawn or revoked that consent. Here we go again with that word revocation. Revocation is that word that I think is so important in this whole context. And just from a practical consideration, as Roseanne and I have said over and over, anytime someone withdraws consent, revokes consent, whether you believe or not they didn't do that in the proper manner, it should have been done in writing. But once that's communicated, the best and safest course to minimize your risk is to honor that and to comply with it. So with eSign, again, you need to get that consent, and the consent is critical. And prior to consenting, you have to provide them with a clear and conspicuous statement of all their rights and their rights to withdraw, et cetera. Next slide, Mike, 27. And in short, you can read the slide. We're not going to go over it in extraordinary detail, but these are some of the rights that, with regard to obtaining the consumer's consent, right? The e-sign, the disclosure has to tell them that they have the right or the option to receive information on paper if they want, that what the transaction relates to at issue. And what's critical is that right to revoke, or that right to withdraw that consent freely. We have to describe the procedures that a consumer can use to update their contact information. And then you have to actually get into the hardware and the software requirements for accessing and retaining records. And then explain how the paper disclosure, has been given, and describe any associated fees, if there are. I know this sounds daunting, but there's an easy way to do it. There's an easy way to roll it out. And it's just, of course, building your e-sign consent. And once you have the e-sign consent built, it's just going to work. And, of course, as the law changes, you may have to tweak it. But David, this is not a difficult thing to get. Yes, Roseanne.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I want everyone to really pay attention to that that statement in blue, because it's also true that consumers must consent electronically or electronically confirm consent in a manner that reasonably demonstrates their ability to receive or access the information electronically. So, for example, let's say you had a text message program and you sent the consumer the elements of e-sign consent. Guess what? You can have this on paper. It applies to all accounts in our possession now or in the future. You can withdraw it at any time. We're not going to charge you any fees. Update us on our website or call us on Monday through Friday. You have to have a smartphone if you're going to, do texting. You have to have a phone that has the capacity to text, obviously, not some old flip phone that doesn't. And then how to obtain paper disclosures. And then you can put that in a text and then ask the consumer to agree to effectuate your e-sign consent. In other words, click reply or hit reply. And then they reply, and then boom, you've locked down. You now have e-sign consent, which means you have the consent, as David so aptly explained, you have consent to send legally required as well as any other kind of information, but legally documents that otherwise would have to be in writing and provided to the consumer by U.S. Postal Service or hand delivery or certified mail. You now can do it digitally because you have this consent. So you don't need, you know, you could do it on a web, you could do it in the email, you could do it in a text, you can do it on the phone, you could do it in an IVR. You can obtain the e-sign consent in many different ways within your organization. But the consumer has to demonstrate that they can text or email at that mobile number or email address, or it fails.
Excellent. That's a great point, Roseanne. It is important with regard to e-sign. So we're going to sort of dovetail back in a way with e-sign. We're going to come back to it when we're discussing certain issues and where it has practical applications so you can clearly understand it. But let's first, before we do that, Mike, let's go to the Lavallee case again. And the reason why we want to come back to the Lavallee case on page 14 is that it is such an important case, because how it can technically bode for how other courts are going to handle similar issues with regard to email in the future. It's also a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal decision, which then now is binding law for Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois. So those are fairly important states, and those are states that have certainly issued case law rulings that have been adopted by states throughout the entire country and other federal circuit courts of appeal. So let's just talk about what Lavallee was and Lavallee did and why it's so important and why we want to talk about it. So in Lavallee, basically, the consumer at issue was sent a fairly generic email that really didn't disclose anything. All it did is have the name of the entity, MedOne, who was sending the email, the plaintiff's email address, and basically provided her with an email that just said, you know, to obtain information, please click here. And there was nothing in there, but what the company tried to do, the company was trying to impart and send to the consumer at issue a 1692G validation notice. But the notice was not set forth in the email. In other words, if you opened the email, you would see the G notice right there. No, it was in a link. But by even clicking on that link, what the consumer at issue had to do was to go through many, many steps in order to get to the G notice. There were some privacy issues, just the private and secured information that the person had to deal with before they could get to it. Well, in this Lavallee case, the plaintiff never even opened up the email. However, MedOne in this particular case had treated as if a proper 1692G notice had been sent. And because of that, they went on and did what they did and just went on and proceeded to do their standard debt collection when believing that the 1692G notice had been sent. And I just want to preface this by saying that before they had sent this email with what they thought was a G notice within it, they did have a phone call. And that phone call did concern the debt and was, for all practical purposes, a communication about the debt under the FDCPA. So, as many of you know, under the FDCPA, right, once a person sends or has a communication, then there is the 1692GA requirement that says then if you have a communication with a debtor and you don't disclose all of the information in 1692G, within 5 days thereafter, that information has to be sent to the consumer. So look, in this manner, the the consumer never opened this email at issue. And so the whole question for this court was a 1692G notice sent? And what the court did is say, well, let's figure out, first of all, if this is even a communication about a debt. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said this particular email that you sent to this consumer was not a communication about a debt, because basically it didn't impart any information. Because they said under a communication under the particular act has to convey information regarding a debt. That email said nothing. That email only had an email address and basically said, you know, click here to get important information. But that, according to the Seventh Circuit, wasn't a communication about a debt. And they said it certainly wasn't the sending of a G notice, because the G notice wasn't contained within the email. They said at best, what you have done here is sent a some kind of digital pathway that gives that consumer an access to that required information, but it wasn't the information itself.
Well, remember, so it's not because it wasn't in the email. It was because they knew they never accessed the link.
Right. Well, they never. Well, it was in the email. The link was there, but she never even clicked on that link.
So. But the reason I just don't want the audience to misinterpret what you said. It didn't fail because they didn't put the G notice in the email, the body. They had a link and they knew she never clicked it.
Right. Yes. And I'm sorry. I should have clarified that. So she never clicked it. So they knew that she never had received it.
Right.
So because of that, the court said, look, that's basically, you didn't, this wasn't not a communication, wasn't a communication about a debt, and you did not deliver the 1692G notice. So when you went forward and started to then proceed with your debt collection, you failed to give the consumer here a G notice, because you knew, in fact, that she did not open that link. And that's very, very important. Next slide. So again, that the email did not convey any information about a debt, therefore wasn't a communication, therefore wasn't a G notice, and then failed the G notice rule, which is 1692 GA2. It didn't have any of the statutorily required or mandated notices that you have to give when you do a G notice. Very interesting in this case is the fact that the CFPB in this particular case actually submitted an amicus brief in support of their own position, which was that, that look, in order to have sent this email with a G notice, what the Med One should have done is first obtain e-sign consent. And the reason that the CFPB was pushing that was because they had, the company already had a communication about a debt. And therefore, under 1692 GA of the FDCPA, at that point, what that triggered is that duty therein, where the consumer had to then provide a written notice regarding all of the 1692 required G disclosures. So at least the CFPB was pushing this whole concept of e-sign, saying that you didn't have e-sign consent, so therefore these emails, you didn't satisfy that written notice under the 1692 GA rule. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals stepped back and said, look, we get where the CFPB is coming from, but we're just not going to go there and we're not going to address this issue, because we already decided that this person didn't get the G notice because, number one, she didn't click on it, and there was nothing in the email except that conveyed any information about the debt. So therefore, we're not going to even get into the whole e-sign issue, and we're not going to really address it. But this brings up an important point, and that is that, as you know, under 1692G, again, it says within 5 days after that initial communication with a consumer regarding a debt, right, if the information in the G notice that is required is not contained in that initial communication, then you have to send that consumer the written notice containing all the G notice requirements. So in this case, the CFP was saying, because you already had a oral communication which didn't provide all of the required disclosures from 1692 GA, you had a duty then within 5 days to send the consumer a written notice containing all of those disclosures. And because it triggered that mandatory written notice requirement, that triggered e-sign, because remember what we said, if there was a statute that mandated that you send the consumer a written notice or a written notice of requirements, then you have to get e-signed consent before you do it. And because this company first had the oral communication, that triggered that written notice requirement. And at least in the CFPB's mind, that triggered the e-signed consent before you can send an electronic delivery, an email with the G notice. However, Roseanne, let's pose this. Roseanne, had the company not had that first oral communication, correct? And if they sent as their first communication to the consumer at issue, the 1692 G notice, let's say within an email, let's just say it was within the body of the email it sent, forget about the link for a moment, we'll come back to that. But if they sent that G notice as the first communication with this particular consumer and they did it via email, do you believe that would trigger the requirements of e-sign?
I do not. And let's take a look at why. Mike, could you go to slide, what I'm thinking might have been 27, real quick? It's the language of the FTC. One more. That one. Thank you. 28. So let's take a look at what David said. See the language of the law here? Notice of debt, validation of debts. This is 16. This is the section we're talking about here. So it says within 5 days after the initial communication with a consumer. So first of all, what do you need to have to go forward with this sentence? You need an initial communication with a consumer. So within 5 days after the initial communication with a consumer in connection with the collection of any debt, a debt collector shall, unless the following information is contained in the initial communication, or the consumer has paid the debt, we've underlined this and bolded it, send the consumer a written notice containing. So when you see words like, this is a statute, so remember e-sign. If you have a rule or a statute that requires you to provide a disclosure to a consumer in writing, ta-da, then e-sign consent is required. But if you really break this sentence down, it says unless the following was in the initial communication. This means that if you put all of this in the initial communication, there is no writing requirement. So you could provide a consumer using a text or an email with the information here, items 1 through 5, the validation notice requirements, without complying with e-sign, because the writing requirement doesn't apply to an initial communication.
So Roseanne, stepping back for a moment and just looking at Lavallee, and in Lavallee, of course, the first communication that the company had with the consumer was a telephone conversation, and the debt was discussed. And as the Seventh Circuit said, well, that certainly was, quote, a communication of the FDCPA because it was a communication about a debt. So therefore, you had a communication. And therefore, the next step, right, once because you had that communication, and in that communication, you didn't disclose all of the 1692 GA requirements, therefore, you had to send the consumer the written notice containing all of that, correct?
Right.
Right. But if they hadn't had that first oral communication, and if the first communication was the 1692 G notice, they could have potentially avoided the ramifications or having to get e-sign consent, correct?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. That's absolutely
great.
True.
Another hypothetical. Sorry, just to interrupt. Another hypothetical question has been submitted. If Med1 had included the letter in the body of the email with no link, would they likely have prevailed?
No, and that's the link became an issue in this case only because it gave the court the opportunity to say she never clicked on the link. How can you expect that she received something she never clicked on and you knew she clicked on it? So if your question is, well, what if they put it in the body of the email? Well, that would have avoided this whole issue about she never clicked the link. So if she these are the ifs. If she opened the email, which you can determine, and if she and that was your initial communication, then this case wouldn't have had legs at all, because the initial communication doesn't trigger the writing. We know this company didn't get e-sign, but if they had put the text of the G notice in the body of the first communication and emailed it to her, and they knew she opened it, then they would be fine. You still can't send things digitally, whether it's in the body of a text or an email or a link from a text or an email. You still can't just send it and then say, well, we sent it. Because this is where we're going to get into the mailbox rule. You have a duty when you're sending a digital communication to work with your providers, if you will, to tell you, did they open the email or did it bounce back? Did they click the link? You know, was it a bad
text?
You have to know what happened to that. You can't just send it out into the ether and then just say, well, we sent it. That's kind of what happened to Med1. They said, well, we sent it. But yeah, but she didn't get it. Yeah. I knew she didn't get it.
And what's interesting, and it's sort of, if you look at this from a practical consideration, this company did have the analytics. They had everything they needed to do this right. They knew, in fact, she didn't open the G notice, so that she never saw it. In a way, that would be akin, as some courts have said, that it's as if you had mailed a letter to someone under the 1692 G notice. You mailed it to the consumer at their last known address, but then you got returned mail, and you knew, in fact, that they didn't receive your G notice because you got returned mail. Here, they absolutely knew that she didn't open the G notice, yet went forward with their debt collection process without, you know, knowing whether she did or did not open it. And I think Roseanne and I want to make very clear that, yes, if the company had put the content of the G notice in the body of the email, and then they had the analytics to demonstrate that she in fact received that, that would have helped them. However, that wouldn't, and at least in Roseanne, in my view, in this particular case, have avoided, of course, the requirements of e-sign, because we said she still had a initial communication about the debt that was oral, that didn't provide all of the disclosures that 1692 GA requires. So that triggered the, quote, duty to send the written notice, which then triggered e-sign. So we just wanted to make sure that we're clear on that. And Roseanne and I want to make a distinction between electronic delivery of email and then the mailbox rule. And this was an issue that at least the federal district court in this Lavallee case pointed out. And they said, look, you know, there's a mailbox rule out there with regard to letters that are mailed. And it's that mailbox rule is generally in most states, a letter mailed is deemed received within 5 business days or something to
that
effect.
3 days.
3 days. Okay. Three business days.
If sent by postal U.S. first class mail.
Right. And to the last known address of the consumer that you had on file. So many people have always said, well, wait a second. The consumer is saying that I didn't get the 1692 G notice that you said you mailed on January 1st. I never got it. Therefore, you didn't satisfy your duty. Well, there's many courts throughout the country, including the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Mahon case, which said that if you sent a letter in the regular course of your business and you have a protocol and procedure to do so, then we're going to deem that that letter was properly sent and you have fulfilled your 1692G notice requirements, whether or not the consumer did or did not receive it, just so long as you don't know that they didn't receive it because you didn't receive, let's say, a returned piece of mail. And that's the distinction right now between email, which is an electronic delivery, and the mailbox rule. With the mailbox rule, something is deemed received after 3 business days after you mail it in due course, right? But we don't have those same rules with regard to e-sign. There is no, quote, e-sign mailbox rule. That's why Roseanne and I were saying you must have, whoever you're using as your provider in email, must have the sophisticated analytics that tell you whether someone did receive a particular email and whether they opened it. There's analytics that are so sophisticated today, they can tell you if someone received something and if they actually opened it and read it. And I'm not talking about the simple little options that you have in your Outlook email where you can confirm if someone email was received. This is much more sophisticated, and there is an extraordinarily high percentage in which they can absolutely confirm that it was in fact received. Mm-hmm. So Roseanne, let's talk about the fact here in Lavallee. Let's do a little different hypothetical. Let's just say that everything was done. Let's just say, first of all, that the email at issue was the first communication MedOne sent to this particular consumer. There was no first oral communication. Mm-hmm. Okay? So let's just say that's our premise. And let's just say that they did include the G-Notice in a link, but in fact the consumer did open it, and MedOne did in fact have the analytics to demonstrate that she absolutely received it and did in fact open it, so then she received it. What were your thoughts about whether, quote, a G-Notice in that kind of circumstance was delivered to the plaintiff?
I think the G-Notice was delivered to the plaintiff, but there's a big but here. In that example, we did not have e-sign triggered because it was the first communication.
Correct.
So number two, we know that she clicked on the link. So then, absent any other random facts, the debt collector, as a matter of, I mean, I think the bona fide heir would certainly protect the debt collector from any claim that she did not receive the G-Notice. And here's what David and I talked about at length yesterday. If you're tracking with us this far in the conversation, here's the next question. In the example David just gave, email, first communication, G-Notice, it can be in the body of the email or it could be a link. I don't really care for right now. And clearly somebody opened it. What if the address you used to send it to this person was their work email address? Let's say that consumer even gave you their work email address and said, David, yep, I'm all in on this email thing. You can email me at blah, 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 you know, carlsonlaw.com. Okay.
Okay.
The debt collector now definitely has the consent to use that email address. This is all.
But do I have to get that consent? Do I have to get consent generally?
Oh,
for
I
email?
Don't think, no, you don't legally need okay. to get obtain the consent
Correct.
Of the consumer. But in this case, since that's how you obtain the, I'm just trying to, you're right. You don't need email consent. Let's remember to talk about that. But you did get the consent of the consumer, which kind of helps the story. And they did give you a work email address. And now you send a G-Notice to that work email address, and the consumer is no longer at that place of employment. Granted, it would have to be 5 days. But yes, go ahead.
So great hypothetical. So if that consumer had given you consent, send me your communications there. And in fact, you can send me, if for any debts or accounts that you may be assigned in the future, you can email me at the address as well. And I'm telling you, it's my private email address. I'm good to go. Mm-hmm. But now you've added in the additional wrinkle of the fact that the person has left the office. However, someone else looks at that email, or the owner of the company has access, or the supervisors, et cetera. She's no longer there, but they're monitoring her email.
Right.
They see that email. They do open that email, and therefore the company gets the bounce back or the analytic result that says, oh, I sent my 1692G notice. I did send it with permission. I had consent to send it at the business address. And now I have the analytics that show that it was opened and it was actually reviewed. Ha, I fulfilled my duty. I sent the 1692G notice. Roseanne, what do you say? Did she receive the notice or did she not?
Well, we know she didn't. Because
Absolutely.
She's not there. Somebody else did. And so it is for this reason that your bona fide heir, your defense lawyer like David could probably get, I'll say he could get you out of this case. I'll say it that way. He can't say that. But no, there's no guarantees. But because you had adopted a procedure, you got the direct consent from the consumer to use the email address. They gave you the work email address and you relied upon it. And you have that recorded and you've saved that recording or any other documentation you may have. I believe you have a procedure in place that was likely to prevent the violation that occurred from occurring. Boom. Bona fide.
And Roseanne, if we could add one more thing, let's just say in that consent that you had already also said to the consumer that in the event that you leave your company or that address is no longer valid, you agree to immediately notify us. Okay.
Right. Let's say you did all those wonderful things. Then I think it's a defensible claim. Now, it doesn't matter. This isn't a question of whether David and I agree or it's what you listeners want to do. Some of us think that it would behoove you to explain to a consumer, if you're getting their direct email from them on a portal, on the phone, IVR, any other place, any way, shape, or form, that you would explain before they, you know, when they're filling in their email address, we suggest that you use a personal email address that only you can access for privacy reasons. The information we may share with you is, you know, could be confidential or may be confidential. If you insert an email address, please be aware that this is, you know, your employer may be able to access it. Something like that, where you're placing the person on some sort of a notice. I don't think we should assume that every consumer understands that or even anticipates what a debt collector could potentially email them at work. You know, they may not even have a clue of how this process works. So that's why we think you should have give them some advance notice. Now, the CFPB and the proposed rules, they're very clear when you can and cannot use a work email or a work mobile number. And one example I could be off by a little bit, but I don't think I am. The only time under the reasonable procedure, say 1006.6, I think, definitions, but there is a reasonable procedure you may adopt. And they say that if the consumer emails you from using their work email address, first, it's kind of like kindergarten. Well, they did it first. You know, if they use their work mobile number first to communicate with you, then you have the right to use that work email or work mobile number until they say don't. But that's really the limited exception. Otherwise, the new proposed rules are not real big on work emails or work mobile numbers at all.
So, Roseanne, look, we just talked about this, and we talked about, hey, you know, in a defense position, you know, because you've gotten the consent and you obtained all this information, and you've, let's say, either got it over the phone and you've captured that via recording, so you've got the evidence to back it up,
yeah.
Or you have, let's say, captured it via the terms and conditions, and those terms and conditions, as we said, went so far as to even say that you agree that at any time that your email address changes or is no longer applicable, or if you leave, that you will notify us. let's just say we get all that and we're good. You know, it still seems that with regard to, at least before the CFPB rules come into play, that there is some risk in using a work email address, because someone will say, well, I left my employment and I didn't get your G notice. And then if you continue and you go forward in your debt collection process, of course, one of the consumer lawyers is going to bring a claim against you, and it's something that you can defend, but it's going to be costly. So I think in this whole protocol, what Roseanne and I are saying, when you're rolling out an email platform, an email program, it's to consider whether, you know, work email addresses are something that you want to use, and you're aware of the risks, and you're willing to do that, because, you know, how often are you going to get an email address where someone, you know, shortly thereafter does leave their employment and then doesn't get it? But I think so it's not only the someone gets it, it's that also someone may open it, because it is a work email address. And so when you're dealing with work email addresses, it's also so important to consider that, okay, if the supervisor has access to it or the owner of the company does, and this person has left their employment and they open it, now is there a third party disclosure? And that's another issue that you potentially have to deal with. And yes, those are potential issues that we can defend, because the person said, you can send me this email here. It is private and secure, even though it is my work address and only I can access it, et cetera, et cetera. Or I'm giving you permission to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, you may or may not have that bona fide other defenses, such as consent,
right,
and an agreement, because you have a contract now. You have terms and conditions, and someone signed those terms and conditions. That all of a sudden now gives you rights, because you've gotten that in presumably in writing, whether it was on a web form or whatever. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the issues I think that you have to think about and think about, you know, is a work email address something that you want to use, or, you know, it's always, as Roseanne and I say, it's always practical and important to ask someone, is this the email address that you just gave us? Is that a work email address or is that a personal? And if they say work, say we would prefer to send you, you know, the information, because it is private information, to your own personal email. Do you have a personal email? They may say no. It's rare today that people don't have personal emails. So, you know, you may be able to, in part, avoid the work email address. There's ways around it. But these are just some of the practical considerations that Roseanne and I wanted to bring up that I think you should be thinking about when, of course, rolling out your email campaign.
Right.
We've got questions, sorry, that have come in. Maybe we could tackle those because we've only got a couple of minutes left before we reach the top of the hour. One question to clarify: verbal authorization for electronic communication is not sufficient and would need to have electronic approval from the consumer.
Verbal authorization of e-sign consent is not enough, because you need to have them demonstrate they actually can use that text mobile number for text or the email address for an email. So if they just say, oh, yes, I love it, I understand everything you just said, and then click, you hang up, what you've missed with e-sign consent is the fact that they need to do something like, okay, I'll send you a text, just send reply, say yes back. Do something to demonstrate you actually have a mobile phone with that number that can go back. And that's for e-sign. If the person is just asking in general, verbal consent to use somebody's email, verbal consent to use somebody's mobile phone number to send them non-legally required written documents, like here's a receipt, here's a
payment receipt
or a confirmation of paid in full, or yes, we took this off your credit report or something like that, then you can do that verbally. You don't need to have that kind of consent in writing, because you're not sending something legally required in writing.
If you send the validation by email as the initial communication, must you then assure the email is opened by the consumer before you engage in any phone calls or leave a message to assure the validation email is in fact the initial communication?
Yes.
Yes, with regard to that, I would say absolutely yes, because you need to know that they actually received it. Again, unlike a piece of mail where you have the mailbox rule and case law that says, oh, if you mail it, it's deemed received and you fulfilled your duties, we don't have that. So in order to know that you can move forward with your debt collection process, you have to know that someone actually received it and you can actually demonstrate that. Now, the person may still say, I never received that, and you could be in a he said, she said situation, because even though you have the analytics to absolutely demonstrate that, someone could say, well, your analytics may say that, but sorry, I didn't get it. And then you're doing a forensic analysis of their computer to determine if they did or did not. And but getting into metadata, and it's very confusing. But
absent that kind of a consumer just outright denying the reality of the situation, you should be okay. And the person is savvy, whoever asked the question, because they are making sure that they added before we make a call, before we do anything else, because they're trying to not trigger the writing requirement. And that person is right. If you can show that the email that you sent or was accessed, opened on a certain date and time, now you know that you've sent the validation notice to that particular consumer. So assuming that email is associated, then you're good.
Right. And then technically fulfilled your duty under 1692G.
Right. But if they never opened it, and then you go and call them, shoot, now your call was the initial communication, and now you better figure out a way to send them that validation notice in a manner that works.
And also, it's also, the question is also, I think, very good, because it sort of sums up everything we were talking about. It is that by sending that 1692G notice as your first communication to the consumer, you're not triggering the e-sign consent that you would have to get under 1692 GA. So that's also important as well.
Yeah.
Very good question.
Can you request a read receipt from the borrower when sending an email?
You can, but remember, not a lot of people sometimes don't respond to those read receipts. You can do it. And if you do that, I think it's going to give you additional indication that someone actually has Reddit. I think it just layers on your email consent from the analytics standpoint. In other words, if you have the analytics that they received it, opened it, and that they have confirmed that they have opened it because you've got that read receipt and the analytics are sophisticated enough to demonstrate that, that's just the layer, you know, that's just some icing on the cake. But they don't have to.
Yeah, they don't have to, but I kind of like the idea, right. And I'm almost kind of embarrassed that I didn't think of it. But I can't see any legal reason. The only twist to that is if they don't do it, if they don't do the receipt, then you know, if they don't do the read receipt business, then you know that it wasn't there, it wasn't sent. I guess that's a question. If they don't click the read receipt, can you use analytics to show, yes, they did open it? I know they did. I don't know if you want to get into that fight. I guess if you use a read receipt and they don't work with you and acknowledge that, you know, click yes to acknowledge the sender wants you to tell them you read it, you know, that whatever that language is. If that doesn't work, then you're going to have to mail it. On the other hand, it's kind of a nice guarantee, right? It's kind of a nice...
It is. I like it because I think it adds one more layer, and it's one more layer of your evidence of proof that when you're providing to your attorneys, it just gives us one more piece of evidence, right, that we can use in the arsenal to demonstrate it was sent, you received it, you opened it, and you confirmed that you actually read it.
Right.
So it helps. Someone could still say, I never clicked on that, but short of that, you've got three pieces of indicia, and three is better than two, and two is better than one.
Right.
But not only that, you know, you have to, what would be good if when you're rolling out your email platform, and such as, and that issue that you just mentioned with regard to that read receipt, it may be a very good idea to just test it out. See what kind of responses you're getting. See if consumers are clicking on that read receipt that you have sent to them. And if you find out that most people to whom you're sending emails, you know from they've opened it so that they did get the G notice, you know, but you see consistently that no one is clicking on that read receipt, you may want to then probably do away with that that particular edition, because it's not working, right? It's not working for you, and it could be used against you by the plaintiffs and the plaintiff's bar. So it's something to think about as you're going through this whole process. And look, at this is all of this is new, all of this is tried and true. So some of it is by testing it to see what works for you and your company and what's working literally with the consumers.
Well, David, Roseanne, thank you so much for coming back and finishing the presentation. And who's asked questions for both webinars. Thank you. This was awesome. I really appreciate your time and your continued support to helping the industry better understand these important topics. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for attending. Thank you, Ontario, and thank you, Mike Gibbon, Accounts Recovery.
Same here.
Awesome, everybody. Yes.
Great
Thanks
weekend.
To everybody who participated.
Have a great Friday.
You too. Thanks to everybody who participated. Thanks to Ontario Systems for sponsoring. A recording of this event will be posted probably by Monday to accountsrecovery.net webinar recording page. Everybody have a great weekend. Thank you.